Are U.S. elections fraudulent? What, if anything, has the electoral recount campaign spearheaded by Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein actually achieved? Should CIA claims of Russian hacking of the 2016 election be taken seriously? How is partisanship and the media contributing to the emerging political turmoil surrounding the election, and why? Is there a chance that the presidency of Donald Trump could be overturned? What could ongoing challenges to the Trump presidency mean for American democracy in the long term? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a look at the myths and realities circling accusations of election fraud in last month's U.S. presidential election, and where uncertainty from the results may lead. We'll hear from a legal counsel to the recount campaign who has researched and authored two books on election fraud in Ohio in the 2004 election, Bob Fitrakis. We'll hear from a political commentator who researched electoral fraud in the Democratic primaries, Debbie Lou Signan, a.k.a. Sane Progressive. And we'll hear from Michelle Chalcedovsky, who interprets what he sees as a campaign to discredit President-elect Trump and what it means for the future. On this week's program, Constitutional Crisis, Part 1. Interference in the U.S. general elections. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 16th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, on the occupied territory of the Anishinaabe peoples and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. The show can be heard on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States, and is archived on the website globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. For the first time since mid-2012, nearly all eastern Aleppo residents are free from captivity, held against their will as human shields by U.S.-supported terrorists. Ain't the way Western media see it, blasting out fake news headlines and reports, supporting Obama's genocidal war, mocking the suffering of Syrians and all people devastated by U.S. barbarism. The latest from RT International indicated Russian UN envoy Vitaly Churkin confirmed an agreement for remaining eastern Aleppo terrorists to leave, quote-unquote, within hours, Syria guaranteeing their safety, provided they surrender their arms and cease fighting. Once their withdrawal is completed, remaining eastern Aleppo residents are safe to stay in their homes. The entire city will be free at last from the scourge of U.S.-backed terrorists, at least for now. That comes from the article, Fake News Liberation, Western Media Lies and Fabrications, the words terrorists or Al-Qaeda are not mentioned, by Stephen Lendman, posted December 15th. Most mainstream media will accuse Syrian government forces of committing atrocities against civilians, describing Aleppo as a humanitarian crisis. What they fail to mention is that for the last 4 years, the eastern part of Aleppo has been occupied by Al-Qaeda terrorists who are now upheld as opposition rebels. The terrorists are described as the victims of Syrian government aggression. From the very outset, the atrocities committed by the terrorists are casually blamed on Syrian government forces. Moreover, the Al-Qaeda-affiliated rebels responsible for countless atrocities are trained and financed by U.S., NATO, and its allies, including Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and Israel. That comes under the headline, Video on the Liberation of Aleppo, Defeat of Al-Qaeda, Agreed Safe Withdrawal of Al-Qaeda Rebels from Eastern Party of City, by South Front and Professor Michelle Chalcedovsky, posted December 13th. The BBC, in its article, Aleppo Battle, UN Says Civilians Shot on the Spot, would admit, quote, yesterday evening we received further deeply disturbing reports that numerous bodies were lying on the streets, Mr. Colville added, while admitting it was hard to verify the reports, unquote. It should be noted that the BBC left the accusation on their website for hours before eventually adding that the reports were both unverified and acquired by quote-unquote sources, not by UN staff firsthand in Aleppo. The purpose of this was to maximize the initial impact of the shocking, easily retweeted headline without being burdened by providing evidence. Once the headline went viral, the BBC eventually filled in the details, which, had they been included in the initial report, would have significantly blunted the impact of the headline. That comes from the article, Unverified Aleppo On-the-Spot Executions, Western Media Disinformation, by Tony Cartolucci, posted December 14th, originally appearing at Land Destroyer Report. Captured Palmyra is just a symbol of success for ISIS. The things that matter are the oil and gas fields, Jazal and Al-Sher, controlled by the SAA. Depriving Damascus of a possibility to maintain control over the fields, distracting the government forces from liberating Aleppo, and lowering their morale are the main targets of the coalition up till now. Another proof of these is that on December 8th, Barack Obama waived any arms export control restrictions on providing military assistance to any and all foreign forces in Syria. The Syrian army keeps advancing in Aleppo, and the West-backed terror groups are surrendering and fleeing the battle, forcing the U.S. to use all means to prevent the victory of Damascus. That comes from the article, The ISIS Offensive Against Palmyra, a U.S.-NATO-sponsored operation, by Mehmet Ersoy, posted December 14th, originally appearing at Inside Syria Media Center. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Several irregularities have emerged detailing problems with the way citizens' votes were tallied in the recent U.S. presidential election. As reported in Global Research's Election Day coverage, 1 million Ohio voters had been purged from the voter rolls, the majority of them being African American, a demographic traditionally Democrat-leaning. There were also instances of voting machines malfunctioning and questions about the alarmingly frequent use at the time of provisional ballots in some black districts necessarily be counted. Additionally disturbing was the discrepancies between the exit polls and the official vote tallies. These discrepancies emerged in fully 12 U.S. states. According to our first guest, Bob Fitrakis, the difference between how people actually voted and how they said they voted was large enough to warrant inspection, according to U.S. State Department standards. Fitrakis also asserts that there are partisan, for-profit, private companies who secretly program the central tabulators, the machines, the voter databases, the computers, and other electronic devices involved in the election counting system across several states. Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein raised millions of dollars in just a few days to pay for an official recount of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, states where the margin of victory for Trump were narrowest and where red flags have surfaced over the last 3 weeks. Unfortunately, recount efforts were hobbled and obstructed by what Stein, in a December 13th press briefing, referred to as political cronyism, bureaucratic hurdles, administrative hoops to jump through, and legal maneuvers. We spoke to Bob Fitrakis the day after the Stein campaign announced it had abandoned its fundraising drive to pay for the vote recount to get an overview of the recount campaign and where the election integrity movement goes from here. We're joined once again by Bob Fitrakis. He is a political science professor in the Social and Behavioral Sciences Department at Columbus State Community College. He co-authored with Harvey Wasserman two books detailing election fraud in the 2004 presidential election in Ohio. He's executive director of the Columbus Institute for Contemporary Journalism and editor and publisher of the Columbus Free Press. He ran as the Green Party's candidate for Franklin County Prosecutor in 2016 and currently serves as legal counsel for the Stein campaign and its efforts to demand a recount of the electoral vote in three states. He joins us now from his home in Columbus to give us an update and breakdown of those recount efforts and help put them in the context of the turmoil unfolding on the eve of an electoral college vote. So welcome, Bob Fitrakis.
Glad to be here.
What are some of the indications that you have that the actual vote is actually different from what is registered?
Well, they admitted it was different. When we went in, Trump was winning by 30,000. As soon as we asked for a recount, Trump lost 7,000 votes. As many small towns where Trump was doing well admitted, a few of them, that they had run the ballots through twice. Thus, if there was a $500 vote lead for Trump, by running them through twice, you've just created a 1,000-vote margin in that small town. So right there, there was a 7,000-vote correction. The other problem is where we really thought the irregularities would be in the city of Milwaukee, particularly in the urban areas where minorities were, we didn't get to actually see the votes there. We were never allowed, for the most part, to actually look down and see if there was a mark on the ballot and that that mark wasn't counted, nor were we ever able to see the SIM cards connected to cell towers, which allows data to be two things. It allows that data to be inputted from the outside, as well as it allows that data to be sent out in different form. So if you're paying $3.5 million and you can't count a majority of the votes in the state, someone's got to wonder what's wrong with our system.
The Board of Electors doesn't acknowledge or actually refutes the idea of internet connectivity, do they not?
Well, you know, well, ESNS puts it right on their machines. So if you go to, I'm sure they would not admit to that. But why don't you go listeners and people watching this, go to ESNS and see what they say. You know, these companies have long bragged about the ability, you know, to download, to program, to troubleshoot from a distance.
Okay. So what about...
And also we have on tape election officials bragging about the SIM cards and the and explaining they were tied to cellular towers.
Okay. So what about, like, I know that there's another irregularity with regard to these, I think it was in Michigan, there were these ballots, like 75,000 so-called undervotes in which,
sure,
you know, that where you don't have, the machines aren't recognizing certain votes, which could have been collected in a hand count.
Yeah, the it's much like people who have taken a test with a number two pencil that have been scanned through machines, so-called, you know, Scantron test. In this case, 28,000 in the Detroit area, which voted overwhelmingly Democratic, it was not picking up and claiming there was an undervote. Now, the ballot they use there is one of the most troubling. It's an arrow on one side, a quiver, and it points, and you're supposed to connect the dot in the middle. Very confusing ballot. Some people with those ballots will actually check the name of the candidate that the arrow essentially points to, or circle it, or mark it. So there, those types of ballots are prone to undervotes. And you got to remember, these people came out and in many of these cases voted up and down the ticket for the Democratic Party and left the name off on the top of the ticket. So we weren't allowed in Detroit because of rules there to count 59% of the precincts. Actually, there was a pickup of vote. The limited amount of counting in Michigan had Clinton up about 77,000. It was primarily done in the southeastern part there. But it wasn't done in Detroit because if a security seal is broke or there's more people signed in than ballots or more ballots than people signed in, they call it corrupted and they don't count. Although the Secretary of State there is going to count the ballots after the fact. It just will not impact the electoral vote in Michigan.
So are there any other glaring red flags or blue flags, as the case might be, that really signal to you that these elections were rigged one way or the other?
Well, in Pennsylvania, where at least 70% of the machines had no VPAT, a voter verified paper audit trail, that is, they have computerized voting machines, which are notoriously prone to mistakes, freezing up, bad calibration, notoriously bad machines. And in this case, there was no way to hand recount them because the legislature had not appropriated money to have a voter verified paper audit trail. In that state, there's something we found in Ohio in 2004, known as the Connally anomaly, named after a Supreme Court judge. That is, there's a baseline vote where the presidential candidate at the top of the ticket runs ahead of the rest of the ticket. And where we suspected fraud in Ohio in 2004, the presidential candidate unexplainedly drops significantly below the top or middle of the ticket and gets this unbelievably low voter turnout, often, 6 to 10% of the expected baseline vote disappears. We found that same pattern among these non-verifiable, totally non-transparent old machines in Pennsylvania that can't be recounted. We found a significant drop off of vote in the Clinton vote in that state.
Okay, so it seems as if the recount effort has run into a fundamental roadblock. I know that we're past the Tuesday deadline, so I get.
Although it really doesn't matter, and Hawaii in 1960 came in much later. I mean, if they count the votes on the 19th, they're not going to throw any out. So, I mean, it's an old, it's safe harbor. All it does is guarantee the votes will be counted. But there's no reason that the votes on the 19th wouldn't have been counted and votes, even after that. So it's a real convenient way to not actually count the votes.
So I guess, I know that this, the Stein campaign, they raised a considerable amount of money to get this recount action happening, and and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they raised more money in just a few days than they did through the national campaign for president.
Yeah, I think it was about double what they raised during the campaign.
Yeah, which raises the question, like how is that possible? Because I have to ask this because there's been a lot of sure. Speculation online that there's some sort of collusion between the pro-Clinton forces who would like to delegitimize the current president and this effort. And so I guess I have to wonder, first of all, is that true? And secondly, if that's how would you account for that huge amount of money that's been raised?
Well, most of it all came in small donations. In fact, the National Party voted not to accept large donations, which would have been up to $100,200. And again, the two states that could have taken $10,000 were told by the Stein campaign not to take any major donations, but to limit them to $2,700. Now, again, I suspect that, obviously some of that money is going to come from Democrats and other people that are concerned, right? Because the Green Party hadn't had that capacity. But I don't know in a recount campaign how you can really filter that as that small money is coming in. All I know is that the party itself at the highest level, the steering committee and the national committee, refused to take $100,000 donations, and the states were told to send back any donation under $2,700. So I don't know what else you do in that situation. My understanding, since I briefed them on the law, I wasn't part of their election. But let me tell you for the record, a week before Thanksgiving, I was in on these meetings. So, you know, I haven't talked about them very much. But 1 week before Thanksgiving week, John Boniface, who, by the way, was the Green Party attorney in 2004 in Ohio, so he has Green Party connections, came to on behalf of 56 or so computer security experts, computer programming professors, and pitched to, I was in on the meeting as an attorney and a political scientist, so was David Cobb and Jill Stein, and he pitched this idea. And also said that, you know, there are people willing to contribute. We didn't hear anything more from him for a week till Thanksgiving week on Monday. We read in the paper that he was pitching the, Hillary Clinton campaign. But, you know, we don't have any proof. We don't hang around in those circles. So that Monday, he came back and said, look, here's all these affidavits, many of them that were entered into court. This was driven for the most part by the people who know the most about computer security in the U.S., people like Alex Halderman at the University of Michigan, the expert witnesses like Harry Hershey, right? It wasn't coming from Jill Stein. In fact, Jill was not enthusiastic about it, nor was David Cobb. I worked with social scientists that I knew, including Ron Behman, who's an expert statistician. We did an analysis, and I published an article called The Strip and Flip Selection of 2016. It's on our site. People can look at the spreadsheet. There's an Excel sheet there. And also, I wrote another one saying that by the U.S. government's own standards, this should be investigated. So at that point, after looking at all that and Boniface coming back on the Monday of Thanksgiving a week, what happened in that scenario, Jill, after studying all the data, and David Cobb said, you know, not just on the recommendations of computer scientists, but on my recommendations, on that of Ron Behman and other people that I was working for. Richard Hayes Phillips had some data that he had posted about the obvious stuffing of votes in Wisconsin. So that's when the decision was made. The next day, and even that night, the steering committee was called. The next day, that Monday night, there was a long meeting when we notified them. So the very day she decided to go forward, the Monday of Thanksgiving week is the day the steering committee began to meet. You know, they turned down, which is their prerogative, $100,000, you know, dollar donations. So the question was, you know, how could we go forward? They looked around, small donations, right? This wasn't put on the web till Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And no one really thought that the money would be raised on our end. In fact, there was investigation, if we were close, of maybe taking out a loan, you know, maybe we could do one state. So, you know, the money poured in, you know, we had raised the Wisconsin money. The deadline was on Wednesday, right after Thanksgiving. We'd raised about $2.2 million, and we're able to go forward there. You know, I know the steering committee of the executive committee, you know, was saying, well, we didn't have enough time. Well, when Jill decided on Monday, you know, they were immediately notified and they debated. That's what executive committees and steering committees are supposed to do. And I think they took the right position. Don't accept any large money. Our main goal was to squeeze off any major Clinton donors.
So I guess I'm wondering what all of this now, like just maybe a final question, what has all this actually achieved, if anything? I mean, is there any Are you just hoping that the word gets out and then people will launch some sort of revision of our system? Are we laying down the foundation for some future lawsuit? What goes on here? Because it looks like we're not going to change. Not that it was necessarily the goal, but
I think the end game, from my perspective, and I argued this repeatedly in the meetings I was in, I would like America to meet minimal standards of democracy. It's my belief that the U.S. system is non-transparent, systematically corrupted through privatization, and does not meet any minimum standard of democracy. Thus, the end game was to expose it. My only regret is I lost the argument, you know, with the litigators, who came out of New York and know how to litigate, but my position was they know very little about elections. And I've co-written 6 books now, including what happened in Ohio and did George W. Bush, win the 2004 election, as well as the strip and flip selection of 2016. But I found that people are too willing to go along with normal politics. I wanted, and I still want, and I'm actually working with what I would call guerrilla lawyers in the field, to declare the recount in Wisconsin illegal, because the election of figures there, including Mr. Haas, who runs the Wisconsin Election Commission, conducted an illegal election and an illegal recount. I think what happened in Michigan is a tragedy of epic proportion. I think it's systematically racist not to count 59% of the votes in the city of Detroit. And Pennsylvania is such a phenomenal joke. If this would have occurred anywhere else outside the United States, and a country would have said, yes, we have private companies, they secretly program these computers, and we don't have any paper in them, so we can't recount, they would have been mocked. They would have been laughed. Our Secretary of State and our government would have pressured them, particularly if they were, not a close ally of the United States, would seem to get exemptions. They would have pressured them into holding a new election and would not have allowed that election to be held without a voter verified paper audit trail. The U.S. system is fundamentally corrupted, is fundamentally undemocratic, and I hope that word spreads. And I really wish we would fought to declare the system in Wisconsin, which didn't allow us to look at a majority of vote, ran the ballots, and in some cases charged us $8, ran them through a machine without letting us look to see if there was a mark for president. Absolutely corrupt state. And I believe they've had rigged elections there under Scott Walker for some time now, including his own recall.
Bob Fitrakis, I'm afraid we have to go now, but I want to thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
We've been joined by Bob Fitrakis, political science professor at Columbus State Community College, and he acted as a legal counsel for the Stein campaign's efforts to demand a recount of the 2016 presidential elections. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Between the Green Party candidate Jill Stein's effort to recount the vote in 3 states, essentially coming to a halt this past week, and now amplified accusations of Russian hacking into America's election system, concerns about the integrity of last month's vote and the legitimacy of the president-elect to govern have entered mainstream media discourse. Debbie Lusignan, otherwise known by her social media handle, Sane Progressive, has been researching and tracking evidence of election fraud ever since the start of the primary season and right through the last presidential election. This information is documented on her site, electionfraud2016.wordpress.com, and her regular Sane Progressive YouTube channel. She joins us now from her home in the state of Massachusetts. Hello, Debbie, and welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Hi there. Thank you for having me on again.
So it's a pleasure. Yeah, we've been hearing a lot about election rigging in the last election, and finally it seems to be more dignified to talk about it. However, it's that there's that twist about Russian hacking that seems to have really blown up over the last week, and it's all over mainstream and social media. And so I thought, as somebody who I think you've spoken with many election integrity people, and you've, of course, done all that documentation yourself. You're very much an election integrity expert in your own right. I thought maybe you could help us, separate the ice cream from the bowl feces when it comes to this question. So, election. We did talk to Bob Fitrakis earlier and about the whole election recount and all of that, the observations happening there. But I was wondering if you could maybe help introduce us to other aspects, other factions of the election integrity community who could, who may be saying slightly different things. I mean, he's mostly seems to be focused on a lot of the way people who've been in black communities have been stripped of their vote, or indications of a move toward Trump from Clinton voters. What other sorts of theories, if that's a word for it, are there out there, or observations?
I think it's important to start from the baseline. And the baseline is, it is impossible to know the true results of the 2016 general presidential election in the United States of America. We vote on machines that can be, and it's been forensically proven, and there's a lot of research on this, that can be remotely hacked without leaving a trace of evidence, covertly. If you follow Bev Harris's work, she has done an investigation where she covered fractionalizing the vote, which the machines have a built-in mechanism which solely exists to change the way that votes are weighted. So they fractionalize, they percent it, they turn it into a percentage. So one vote doesn't count for 100%. One vote for one candidate can count for 70%, and then a 30%. And so this can be employed. And
could you maybe just, expand on that just a little bit? How would that fractionalized voting scenario work out?
If they implemented utilizing the mechanism, the machine would convert it to a different number, and so you'd still see the same number of votes, but the votes would be weighted differently, and so you would get different election results. And as the recounts have shown, we do not have a system in place where we actually audit our elections. In fact, the laws on the books, whether by specific design or by the fact that they are so old that they do not take into account what would be needed for a full audit and recount, which is one of the things is you would need to do a forensic examination of the actual electronic voting machines to make sure that they weren't hacked, there were vulnerabilities that you weren't aware of. So we don't even have the ability to audit the election. So the baseline is, if you have mechanisms on your machines where the votes can be changed, and we know 100% that that is factually true in this country, then there is no way to know if the vote is accurate, because you cannot know by the design whether those vulnerabilities have been exploited. So nobody knows who won the 2016 presidential election. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have to kind of infer it based on statistical analysis?
Faith-based voting.
Faith-based.
Cross your fingers and hope it will count. It's not any way to have an election. And actually, we are in a constitutional crisis within the United States of America right now. The election results are null and void by the way that the election was actually conducted. But that's not what you're hearing. Mm-hmm. This is the baseline. This is the baseline that we talk about. The results should not be certified, and the Electoral College should not go along with them, but not because of the unsubstantiated claims of election rigging that are being put out by anonymous unofficial off-the-record sources, rather, by the CIA in the shadows. That is not what is the story in this election, and the media continues, the corporate fake news media continues to ignore the real story. If people want to understand what's going on here, I would refer everybody to a statement that was put out by the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, a highly respected group of people, Ray McGovern, former Army Infantry Intelligence Officer, CIA analyst, William Binney. He was actually one of the architects of the NSA, Mike Gravel, Kirk Wybie, and among others who have signed on to this. And their bottom line is this. I'm just going to read you two quick paragraphs from the article, and I will give you the link so that you can share it with your listeners. They say the bottom line is that the NSA would know where and how any hacked emails from the DNC are Hillary Rodham Clinton or any other servers were routed through the network. And they say that because of the NSA spying program, which Binney, who signs on, helped develop. And they, in these emails, addresses would be filtered through this program, which catches all emails that go through the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they further, this process can sometimes require a closer look into routing to sort out intermediate clients, but in the end, sender and recipient can be traced across the network. The various ways in which anonymous spokespeople for U.S. intelligence agencies are equivocating, saying things like, our best guess, our opinion, our estimate, shows that the emails alleged to have been hacked cannot be traced across the network. Given NSA's extensive trace capability, we conclude that the DNC and HRC servers alleged to have been hacked were in fact not hacked. They say that they were leaked.
Okay, of course.
Yeah, it's a huge distinction.
Yeah.
And there is a disinformation campaign going throughout the corporate media, which refuses to report on the many known documented problems of our election system and continues to be pushing forward this narrative, which remains completely unsubstantiated by actual objective proof.
Yeah. I wanted to bring up like one other name, because you've laid out like the bottom line, but I am still kind of curious about another individual, Richard Charnin, who he uses a statistical analysis.
Richard Charnin, he's been on my show many times.
Yes.
And you can see his blog. He has done a lot of work exposing fraud in elections. He is a degreed mathematician. He's got two master's degrees in mathematics, and he has been following the fraudulent elections since 2000. His work showed mass election fraud in the Democratic primary. We know that the exit polls did not match the official result outside of the margin of error, often in double digits, which if that occurred in other countries, if there's a 2% discrepancy, the United States State Department won't certify those results. That happened in 11 of the 26 states that had exit polls conducted. And Charnin basically has concluded that there was fraud in the general election as well, but he thinks the fraud occurred from Hillary Clinton and not Donald Trump. And this has turned into a split between the election integrity activist community, as people have theories about basically who cheated more. Is Greg Palast right that the voter suppression and targeting minority voters, which is a tactic that we know that Republicans use, you know, was enough to knock off enough voters to, change election results? Or was, you know, Clinton changing results on the machine, as Charnin and his work tends to indicate? And, the bottom line, again, is even all these discussions are fascinating, but they ultimately are moot because that is not a way to decide an election. We don't know. We don't know. We don't know what happened in 2016.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just because it sounds like, I mean, if there are these divisions, as you point out, like I hear this, the term of, and I'm sure you have as well, divide and conquer. And if people can't unify around the point that you just expressed, that it might threaten to undermine efforts to expose these truths.
I think everyone agrees that the election needed a full audit. Now it has come to light through trying to have this full audit that it is not allowed to go through. The cost of it was astronomical. There was it was blocked by the courts in Pennsylvania and Michigan. It did go through in Wisconsin. But even in Wisconsin, they're going and they're putting the ballots again through machines that counted them in the first place. And if the fraud was occurring on the machines, of course that's not going to expose a mismatch by putting them through the exact same machines.
Yeah, yeah,
again.
like getting a second opinion from the same doctor, kind of thing.
I mean, you know, and it was just revealing kind of what we already knew. Yeah. You know, the discrepancies and the irregularities that were being, you know, shown. You know, they say that the elections are not held online, so thus mm-hmm. they can't be hacked. But the election integrity activists who were overseeing the process found SIM cards and software on the voting machines, which would be indicative of utilizing a system to transmit results via a central tabulator and have yeah. those connect through the machines. And that's long been a way that we've worried that fraud has been occurring on these machines.
Yeah. Debbie, though, I was wondering, though, because a lot of the discussion that's come out of this, it seems to have moved into a partisan direction, you know, where, you know, if you bring up these points, oh, you're for Hillary.
Election fraud is not an issue of partisanship. Election fraud is an issue of democracy. So as I don't support either of these two abysmal tyrant candidates. We don't have a government that represents us on either side. And the longer that people get caught up trying to defend the front person, rather than understand how the system is actually operating, they're going to be staying locked into a dialogue that is determined by nature. The partisan poison pill is how the corporate media talks about this on purpose to keep us divided along these more superficial things so that we actually don't unite around what we actually need to be focusing on.
So are you saying that there are popular and media currents that are somehow keeping people glued to this partisan divide when it should really be a question about integrity, the integrity of elections and looking beyond the curtain as well? Because, like I say, it's very very intelligent people apparently are getting drawn into that partisanship. And I mean, I can't quite make sense of it either. I was wondering if you might have any insights into why that is and how it can be.
This is decades long. People have been exposed to media, right-wing news, left-wing news, and when they frame everything in the terms of Democrat versus Republican, which makes it so they don't have to talk about the issue and they don't have to talk about the fact that both of these parties and many of these politicians, whether they're right versus left, are all operating in the same way. It's like a sports team mentality. And it's very much driven to keep people not looking at the actual policies and issues, but to be aligned with a loyalty to a party or a politician rather than having a loyalty to a policy and truth. And so we don't even know how to have objective political dialogue in our country anymore. And the corporate media is flat out lying to you about a million things. On both sides, the right and the left, they're all owned and they all have the same kind of advertisers and sponsors on both sides. And the corporate media is the biggest lot of hypocrites. And you see them like even let's just take some basic premises of what they're regurgitating right now. They're trying to say that it was Russia's responsibility, which they have had no proof for any of this claim to be involved in the DNC leaks, to try to harm Hillary Clinton through these leaks, which there's no proof of, and thus elevate Trump. This is coming from a corporate media that gave him, and this is according to one of the corporate news media sources themselves, the New York Times, $2 billion of free coverage 24/7 for a year. So who elevated Donald Trump? Was it their nonstop free coverage and exclusion of every other candidate through the coverage of Donald Trump? Or was it Russia? You know, it's like we can't even think in terms of common sense anymore. We don't, people can't even take it back into the foundation of a logical discussion. That's how extreme it's been. We don't know how to approach politics from a baseline. And this is partially our own responsibility as well, because we don't hold to any principle or what we stick to as a belief as a country. The Democrats, for the longest time, every time the Democrats, the Democratic politicians have betrayed them, they've never held the line. They just move the goalpost to accommodate whatever new reality the Democratic Party says is going to exist. And I think now we are at a tipping point. But it's going to be a crazy transition. And you know, as I was telling you offline, you know, our election systems are so infested with corruption, the very way they're run make them invalid as a means to count votes. We don't have the mechanisms to change the laws or change the voting systems, because they are all in these power positions to keep it exactly the way it is. It's the corruption is on the right and the left. The transition for this country is not going to be coming through traditional means. It's going to have to be exactly what you're seeing in Standing Rock. It's going to have to be on the ground direct action. It's going to have to be bank exit and taking your money and changing the way that you spend. It's going to, and this is not going to be a quick process, and most likely it's going to be a painful one.
Okay. Well, I guess on that rather ominous note, I think maybe I'll take my leave of you, but thanks. It's been a bit of a refreshing discussion, and I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you again for having me.
Okay. We've been speaking with Debbie Lusignan, otherwise known as Sane Progressive. You can find her YouTube channel as well as her Twitter and Facebook page. Michelle Chosadovsky is Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and editor of Global Research. He's the author of several books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, America's War on Terrorism, and the most recent, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. He joins us from his home in Montreal. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Chosadovsky.
Delighted.
We're examining the fallout from the recent election and seeing some unprecedented dynamics circling around the legitimacy of Trump's election. On the heels of this election recount, we're seeing pressure on the grand electors of the Electoral College that they vote against the candidate that they were instructed by the electors, the general public, to vote for. It's theoretically possible and apparently legal for them to do so. There's even been a letter sent to the director of national intelligence asking for a briefing on the prospect of Russian involvement in the election. Could I ask, what is the significance of these events in the broader context?
Well, in the broader context, there are two very powerful factions which are competing for the U.S. presidency. The neoconservative Hillary faction on the one hand, and the faction which is supportive of Donald Trump, which now includes some very powerful people, including the CEO of Exxon, who has been chosen by Trump to head the State Department, and then you also have a Goldman Sachs official who has been appointed to chair the Council of Economic Advisors at the White House. Now, what I think has to be addressed is the fact that there's an ongoing propaganda campaign which is based on lies and fabrications, linking Trump to the Kremlin, so to speak. In other words, presenting him as an agent of Moscow. And this is emanating both from the Obama administration as well as from the mainstream media. It's a smear campaign. I'm not saying we're not here building an apology for either of these candidates. Both of them are unacceptable from the point of view of public opinion and the interests of Americans at large. But what is happening is, in effect, is presenting Trump as somebody who's sleeping with the enemy, so to speak, which is an act of treason, okay? It's an act of treason. And it's being used, it says, you know, he's a Manchurian candidate, he's chosen by the Kremlin. The propaganda campaign has gone into high gear. And now what is happening is that a number of the grand electors have been, they've been approached. In fact, most probably they've been approached by both sides. There is a factional clash between these two groups. They are what we might describe as quote-unquote conspiracies to ensure that, at least from the Hillary Clinton faction, to ensure that Trump does not accede to the White House. Mm. Now, I've been looking at this for the last couple of weeks, and I've been able to, in a sense, focus on a number of interrelated elements which suggest that in the days ahead, there is going to be a whole series of actions which are there to prevent Trump from acceding to the White House. There's the propaganda campaign accusing Moscow of interfering in the election campaign on behalf of Donald Trump. These are very serious accusations. There's also the vote recount, which from my standpoint is not an issue. I don't think anything will change in that regard, but there's still a dynamics which is there, and there are legal aspects to that as well. And then, of course, the key element I should also mention the passing of legislation in the Congress, H.R. 693, Intelligence Authorization Act, etc., which includes a section directed against so-called pro-Moscow independent media in response to Moscow's alleged interference in the U.S. elections. Again, another element which is directed against Trump. And then, of course, there is the Electoral College vote, where there's a lobbying of the grand electors, mainly, of course, it's directed against Republican grand electors, to attempt to shift the vote. And some reports have, in fact, suggested that a significant number of grand electors will shift their vote in favor of Hillary. The other aspect are the protest movements, the engineered protest movements, which are organized by various groups associated with the neocon Hillary faction. And then there's also a program to disrupt the January 20th inauguration ceremony. I don't think that will go through, but it's still part of a very broad and interrelated agenda, coordinated agenda.
I was just wondering, like, in terms of the Electoral College vote on December 19th, could you tell me, like, in practical terms, even if there is an overturning of the vote and they go with Hillary, or if Hillary comes out triumphant at the Electoral College, what happens then in practical terms?
I think that what happens then is a constitutional crisis, because the Trump people will come in and there'll be, there'll be legal procedures, there'll be confrontations. They're not going to simply accept that. If grand electors have been co-opted in some particular way convinced to vote for Hillary instead of Trump, I'm sure the Trump side is going to lash back. I don't think it's going to be, whatever happens, it's not going to be a smooth transition. And it's very difficult at this stage to predict. I've been trying to look into a whole series of informations coming out, but it's very difficult to predict what might happen because everything is behind closed doors. If they are scheming, the stakes are extremely high. Can you imagine? Now, I should mention that Tillerson, Rex Tillerson, who is the appointee of Trump to the State Department, he has, on the whole, good relations at a personal level with Vladimir Putin, and Exxon is also involved in the oil and gas industry in the Russian Federation in partnership with Rosneft, the big Russian conglomerate. But on the other hand, Exxon has also interest in the South China Sea and is in confrontation with out of Vietnam and is in confrontation with China. So that what might occur under Trump administration is some shift in geopolitical alliances. It seems to be that there's more sort of hate directed against China than against Russia, so to speak. And but that's nothing new, because we've got the pivot to Asia, which has been ongoing. But under Trump, it might take on a different turn to what, you know, to what it was during the Obama administration.
Professor Chostadovsky, I got time for just one more question, but I think it's a very important one. With this crisis of legitimacy, this constitutional crisis, is there some sort of a kind of a backup, like in the event that we are unsure of who really won the election? Is there any kind of process or procedure conceivably in place that could allow for the government to maintain the basic mechanisms?
Well, you know, as I said, both candidates in a sense are dysfunctional, because if Clinton were to arrive at the White House, she would immediately be haunted by her criminal record and with the possibility of impeachment. And so that's one scenario. The other scenario is Trump arrives, accedes to the White House. This campaign against him is not going to subside. Okay, it's a media campaign, associate him with Moscow. If he arrives, I mean, if he accedes to the White House, they will continue with this campaign against him. They may want to initiate impeachment procedures. So that, in fact, what I'm saying, neither candidate, first of all, serves the interests of the American people. Both candidates are dysfunctional, and I suspect, although this is somewhat speculative, that at some future date, not immediately, we might be moving into a martial law situation with the suspension of constitutional government. That, in fact, there's plenty of legislation to that effect. And then we see also the movement against independent media and so on, freedom of expression, civil rights. That seems to be a tendency, whether it's under the facade of democracy or whether it's under the facade of something else, which is the martial law legislation which has been passed in the last year.
Professor Chostadovsky, I wish we had more time to talk, but I resolved to do more about this issue of Trump and Hillary and the deep state in the new year. Hopefully you'll be able to join us then. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Michelle Chostadovsky, professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research and Globalization, and editor of Global Research. He joined us from Montreal.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. This episode marks the last new regular episode of the Global Research News Hour for 2016. New episodes will start up again in January. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch, wishing our listeners a joyous holiday season and a peaceful and fulfilling new year. Talk to you again in 2017.